Hi, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined today by registered Potterphile, Doug.
What? That came out wrong, I think.
What are you talking about?
I think that
Harry Potter.
I do. No, that's all right. That's all true. I do love Harry Potter, but Potterphile just comes across. It sounds like it sounds like pedophile. It sounds like pedophile.
You know, I did not even put that together.
Hi, Patrick. Welcome. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's early because obviously Doug and I have both been at the midnight and 3 a.m. showings of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, which is the movie that we're talking about today.
Yeah. And if you want to get some crazy stares at the theater at midnight, show up for Harry Potter wearing a Darth Maul costume, because that's what I was doing. And we saw a bunch of, and we saw a movie, not the first showing, but we saw the next day or Friday night showing. And there were still people dressed up like Dumbledore, and we saw some lesbian Harry Potters and little boy Harry Potters or little girl Harry Potters. So it was all over the place. Lots of people with wands.
I had one lady in like a hat, but that was it. That was really it. Yeah.
Well, you saw an early Friday morning show. Yeah,
but it was still crazy sold out.
We saw the Friday, I guess it was like 7:30, 7:45 IMAX.
Prime time. Yeah, listen, we'll get to what you saw, okay? I don't know if you guys remember F This Movie listeners, but back in November, Doug and I did a show on Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Who can remember that far back?
And if you need a little refresher, I suggest you go back and listen to it now. You can find that podcast at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Or hopefully in the iTunes store. We're having some iTunes issues right now. But fthismovie.blogspot.com is a great place to go to find all of our shows. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. And you can email us with all your Potter rage at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you're like, why would you wear a Darth Maul costume? Doug's like, listen, it's a celebration of all walks of life. Why can't all of these fantasy worlds coexist?
I have no doubt also that
I went dressed as the Beastmaster. I had Toto and Frodo with me.
Ferrets in your pants. You're ferret legging, basically, the entire time. I have no doubt also, just knowing you and knowing how painstakingly fastidious you are. That's right. I wouldn't say anal, because anal sounds bad, I think. That people misuse anal all the time. And it's like, please, stop using anal. It's gross. Yeah. That you probably, on the fthismovie.blogspot.com page, will have a link to the previous Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 podcast.
To be honest, I actually meant to have it up like before the new one came out. Just like, hey, everybody go back and listen to this. And I dropped the ball in a big, bad way. But I will have the link to it on this episode, too. So
we're all disappointed in you. Well, me.
Rightfully.
I'm constantly.
Rightfully so. So let's talk Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
We'll do.
We're not going to spoil it for a long time. I was going to try and go 100% spoiler free, but
why would you do that? I was actually going to do 100% spoiler full.
OMG.
For real though, I think that like at this point, if you haven't, well,
yeah,
like,
I mean, I see what you're saying, because who's going to listen to this to decide if they should go see it, right?
Right. Or that you're not going to listen to the part two of a podcast.
Right.
You know, unless you've seen, I mean, there's seven previous full length movies, and this is actually the shortest movie.
Yeah.
Which still, I mean, it goes on a nice clip, but I really think that you should watch the two as one piece.
Right. I see what you're saying. So it's like Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. It's really one movie is what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Let's go spoiler free for just a little while and then we'll get into spoilers. There's one thing specifically that I need to talk about that will be a spoiler. So let's talk Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Douglas, you are... Again, for those who haven't heard our first show, Doug has read all the books. He loves Harry Potter way more than me. I have only seen the movies. So you get two very similar but different perspectives.
We love it.
From the point of view of a fan of the books and the series, how did you feel that the series wrapped up? Was it the epic conclusion you were hoping for?
Yes. Short
Thank
answer,
you very much
yes.
for listening, everybody.
Long answer. I
Long
need
answer,
to go back.
Wrap.
Long answer. You know, it's been a year or 2 years since I've read the books, but I've actually read some stuff online because I saw the movie last night. I mentioned at a 7:45 epic conclusion showing with lots of people. And I was kind of stoked after I saw it. So I went on Twitter and went on Facebook and stuff, and I was looking what people had to say about it. And I saw some people out there And everyone seems to be universally pleased with the movie. It seems like it's done its a good job of making both fans and non-fans happy. But the really diehard fans, and to your point earlier, yes, I have read the books, but I don't really consider myself a Harry Potter expert. I've only read them once, which I know is like, well, that's all you need to read them. But a lot of people out there have read these books multiple times. Yeah. And they have the thing memorized, and a lot of the details really... If it strays, and I think this is the case with any sort of universe, be it Star Wars or Harry Potter or any sort of thing that, especially based on books, turned into movies, if it strays even a little bit, it inflames the rage of a lot of the diehard fans. I didn't feel that way. I'm not a purist. I know some people out there are purists, and they're like, they weren't happy with a couple of the choices because there's, I think the part specifically, and again, I might get flamed on the message boards. We have message boards, right?
I assume so. I haven't seen them, but they got to be there.
I think when Harry grabs...
I haven't seen Heaven either, but that exists.
When Harry grabs Voldemort and jumps off the building...
I remember that in all the trailers.
I don't think that's in the book.
What? No, he goes, you go, we go, and then they jump, right?
Let me go, Bull, he says.
He says 100% pure adrenaline, and then they jump out of an airplane together using the same parachute, right?
Wearing Reagan masks, I think. No, is that the I'm mixing my...
No, you got it right. You got it right.
Meta movies?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think people are kind of like, well, that didn't happen. But it's I think sometimes, obviously, when it comes from books, it's like you can't necessarily filmically capture what is written as narrative or background or you know, voiceover. You can't capture that stuff filmically.
This probably isn't the place to go into this whole discussion about adaptations or whatever, but I don't understand people that get upset. Like, the book is the book. The movie is the movie. They can't be the same. Why do you want to go see somebody just do this completely faithful translation of a book? Read the book if you want that. So,
and some of the things in the book, I think, are kind of a little more out there and filmically would be either impossible to film or require so much CGI and so much fakery that it would look cartoonish. Even the scene in the previous movie, and this is a spoil, well, it's not a spoiler, but the previous movie, they're finding one of the Horcruxes, and it's Harry Potter and Dumbledore in this river, this lake with zombies and stuff. And to get to the bottom of this pool of water where there's a ring, I think, Dumbledore has to drink all the water from a shell. And it's just such an interesting, like, I always look, even as I read it, I'm like, this is just weird. It's just a weird thing. And especially when you watch Harry, like, forcing this liquid down this old man's mouth. I'm just like, it's really, it's kind of visually jarring, I think. And again, to kind of expand on that, a lot of the stuff, be it, you know, inner thoughts of Harry Potter, inner thoughts of whomever, you can't always, or even like the flashbacks to Voldemort. I actually think the film did a great job in kind of mastering subtlety and implied fear, implied, you know, what's happening, what's coming with Voldemort and things like that.
There's a lot of people who like the books and don't like the movies. And again, as somebody, so maybe I come off as ignorant, because as somebody who hasn't read the books, I actually really like these movies. And I said that on the part one podcast, that I'm a big fan of the Harry Potter movies. I feel like the ending, this last movie, was good. I liked it. Yeah. I'm happy with it. If I have complaints, they're kind of minor or weird theoretical complaints. I mean, I think overall people should be at least satisfied with the ending.
Yeah, I think if nothing else, and I think that's what I took away from reading, like I said, on Twitter or Facebook or wherever, I think people have their gripes, but I think it's ultimately a satisfying closure. It definitely has closure.
Yeah, I don't think it's a great movie. I don't think it's one of the best in the series, but I was
really
satisfied with the way it wrapped up. No,
okay.
I think part of that is kind of built in, unfortunately, to the structure of the thing, because it just... it exists only to wrap everything up and to pay off things that have come before. And so, you know, again, my favorite in the series is probably Half-Blood Prince. And the reason for that is personal, obviously, as are everybody's reasons for liking movies. But, like, I think that movie does the best job of exploring all the magic stuff, setting up its own story, playing a large piece in the overall story that, you know, spans the eight movies, I guess, but also focuses on, like, the characters and their relationships. I mean, obviously, again, when I say, like, for personal reasons, is because that's the one that's all about like being a teenager and falling in love for the first time. And I love all that stuff.
Sure.
But it expands on the characters the best and their relationships. And I think it does the best job of including everything that I really like about these movies. Deathly Hallows Part 2 is really just about driving the plot to the end.
Right.
You know?
And I think that's even the
book. It has to be. I mean.
Right. And that's, its hands are tied, obviously, in that respect. There can't be subplots because at this point, it's like shit's flying. You know, like you've got the two armies, basically, of Voldemort's people and like the Hogwarts, the Order of the Phoenix people fighting. It has to kind of come to this epic conclusion.
By the way, conclusion.
There was just a quick side note there before the movie. I don't know if you saw it, too. It was a big deal because the Dark Knight Rises teaser trailer was released. And
it's bad, I'm not crazy. It's bad.
It's, you know, I don't know if bad is the right word. It's really kind of nut. I was going to write, you know, it's some more backstory. Let's just pause Harry Potter right now.
We had the idea for F this movie. Okay, no, we're not going that far back.
Patrick and I went to high school together. He got married. No, I write the Watching Trailers with Doug every Friday. You should check it out. If you listen to the podcast on iTunes or through DVD Verdict, please check out our website. We do this trailer roundup. I'm not saying they're great, but it's a funny 5-minute timeout from your life, hopefully. So check it out. So I write on Thursday nights, and I knew that the Dark Knight Rises teaser trailer was going to be released with the Harry Potter thing. And I wrote this write-up. Wasn't very funny, very brief. Assuming that I would be able to find the teaser on YouTube the next day as it's released at midnight with Harry Potter. And of course, I couldn't find it. So what I did was I actually found a bootleg, which I know, shame on me. But I watched it and it's garbage quality. But I got the gist. I got the vibe. I saw Gordon is in a hospital bed, you know, just basically pontificating, bloviating about the right and wrong and good and evil. And it's very basic and simple. And it's if nothing else, it totally borrows from Christopher Nolan. Like even they say directed by Christopher Nolan, and the letters in Christopher Nolan's name like fall forward like in Inception. The music is from Inception. I mean, he obviously knows what works and it's his stuff, so he can't be accused of stealing, but it's like, wow, this is Inception inspired. And as Shadia pointed out, my wife, you don't even see Christian Bale. And I'm like, well, maybe they haven't shot certain things yet or they're still editing. I mean, it's really sparse and really basic. And I don't even know why I brought this up.
It's a movie because we keep making jokes about the epic conclusion.
That's right.
And this is the epic conclusion. They showed the trailer before Harry Potter and one guy like tried to get applause going and no one joined him. And he's like, really? Only me? And that was kind of funny. But like it didn't inspire applause. I'm sorry.
Right.
Like I don't think it's a bad trailer. But like you said, there's nothing to it. The only real new footage is Gary Oldman in a hospital bed because otherwise it's shots from the previous two movies.
Right.
I don't like the whole like the epic conclusion of the Dark Knight trilogy and from Christopher. Right. I don't like any of that. That's a marketing department, whatever. But like anticipation is so high for this movie and I can't believe that this is what they're willing to go out with as their first look. You know what I mean?
It's just they should have
waited until they had something better. That's all I mean.
Because you definitely want to inspire. I mean, the fanboys and even the people that are kind of moderately interested in Batman will see it.
Yeah, we're excited no matter what. But
you've got an audience of Harry Potter files like me, a Potter file. And a lot of it is, you know, kids and or parents who maybe aren't as into the comic book stuff. You've got this chance to kind of wow them. And you've just got Gordon. And he actually does say some cool things in the teaser, I think. He's like, you know, if he doesn't exist, Batman must exist, you know, like because it's kind of cool. It's kind of like, wow, that's pretty badass. But ultimately, it's like a shot from, I think, Batman Begins.
Yeah, there's...
Yeah.
Shots from both movies and then him doing push-ups and then you get like two really fast glimpses of Tom Hardy as Bane. We're so far off topic. Here's something weird about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Based on people who had read the book and even on something I think you said on the Part 1 podcast is that, you know, we all believed that this was all leading, that the last movie was just going to be this huge battle. And part of me was like, oh, I'm kind of burned out on the big battle, the Return of the King. Like, everything ends with this giant battle between two armies, you know. And then I saw the trailers, and they're really selling it as it's this huge battle. And that got me excited. Like, I will admit that I saw the trailer, and I was like, oh, that's pretty awesome.
So even when you're kind of, like, bummed out, because, like, I'm burned out on the battle. When you saw the trailer about it being a battle, you were excited.
Yeah, then I was like, hey, right on. I'm on board with this battle nonsense.
You just love battles. That's why you can't wait to see Real Steel, because it's all about robots battling.
But the movie is not that. And so I think anybody who hasn't read the books and is thinking like I was, that it's just a 2-hour battle based on the trailers, it is not. Those trailers are misleading.
And again, that's marketing department stuff. Yeah. It's not the fault of Yates, or not the fault, but it's not Yates. I'm sure it's not surely isn't J.K. Rowling. It's like, oh, we have to make it a battle because that's obviously we're programmed to think that way.
It's so kind of secondary. It's this thing that's like only sort of happening in the background in a few different scenes. So that's all. But, you know, I figured I could say that spoiler free if you're going into it expecting it to be this huge, the Battle of Hogwarts, you know, people keep talking about. That plays a very small part in the whole thing, I think.
There's even, and we're, as long as we're spoiler free, I'll make this as ambiguous as possible. There's even a big kind of sequence, or there's a scene where you think it's going to be a huge kind of the crux of the movie, the climax of the movie. And it, when it's over, it takes a 7 to 10 minute pause where it's just dialogue, and it really is kind of an interesting. I wouldn't say it sucked the steam out of the movie, or it didn't, you know, detract or slow things down. It definitely was essential a plot development, whatever. But it definitely was kind of like, wow, that's not. I see that too often. Usually, it's just like build and build and build and louder and Decepticons and Autobots and, you know.
I will say, we'll probably have to move into spoilers pretty soon. I thought we could do it without spoiling, but we probably have to spoil it. I will say that as of right now, the movie is breaking all kinds of records.
I read this morning it's $92 million for Friday alone, which is a one-day record.
Yeah, it made like $43 million just in midnight shows.
Wow, that's nuts.
They're anticipating $100 million 3-day weekend, which will be the biggest of all time by about $40 million. I think Dark Knight did about $140.
I think it's going to surpass that even if it's $92 on a Friday.
Well, you know, but again, you got to remember that a lot of the people that were going to see it saw it, you know, so it's going to slow down a little, I think.
I think a little, you're right, but I think that this is the kind of movie that garners us, especially for those people that saw it and it did satisfy, they'll see it again.
Yeah, definitely.
Too. In fact, I'm off. Right, I gotta go.
Oh, goodbye.
I got Fandango tickets.
Enjoy the movie. I'm really happy about that actually, because I so want it to be to beat Transformers as like the biggest moneymaker of the year. Not that I put that much stock in that, but it's like here's this thing that's taken, you know, it's 8 movies, it's over a decade or about a decade worth of work, and all these people have grown up on screen, and it's this huge, huge accomplishment. Yeah. And if nothing else, again, I said this on the first podcast, but like this is an achievement unlike any that we've seen, I think, in movies before. And I would be surprised if we ever saw anything like it again. And I want that to be rewarded more than Michael Bay's Transformers series, you know?
Well, no, that's based on Hasbro toys, and you have to really give props to the Japanese toy inventor who decided to do a Decepticon, and then 25 years later they did a movie. And it's just like, when you really think, I mean, to your point, when you really think about the inception of like, not to get all like dopey nostalgic or whatever, but like JK, the author who sits down at her type computer, I assume it's a computer, maybe a word processor. I don't know what she writes on in England. It's a lorry. She writes on a lorry where she basically sits down and starts typing, and you've got, you know, I assume that was in the early to mid 90s, and all of a sudden here we are in 2011, and everything, every step of the way, there's all these different factors that could have derailed this. And you're her writing this book, it's you know, proofed, it's approved, it's become a huge sensation. It's a first movie, Chris Columbus, and you've got, yesterday we're driving home and I'm thinking like, you know, if I was the casting director from the first movie, I have to be patting myself on the back at this point, because every single person in that movie is perfect. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe is Harry Potter. I mean, he's kind of a weirdo. He's kind of weird looking, I think, but at the same time, he's still like, it embodies even the book. We have the books. Shadi is actually going through them right now, and I'm looking at the animations, which aren't J.K. Rowling. It's some random person whom I doubt she knew was illustrating chapter starts for each chapter. And it's, you know, from her descriptions to this, you know, cartoonish drawing to the on-screen adaptation, it's like the casting director, I think, did a great job. Everyone, even grew up good. I always know there's a fear or concern when you cast kids that, like, oh, I hope they grow and they're not, you know, just don't turn into horrible mutants. And they all grew up to be great. In fact, Hermione is adorable. I just think she's really cute and just perfect for that thing. And I kind of have a small crush on her, I think.
Well, I don't think you're alone. I think a lot of people do. The series, obviously, it could have gone wrong in so many ways. All of the movies I don't think there's been a bad movie. There's ones that are better than others, but I think they've consistently been of really high quality. And again, they are the series in general is this sort of celebration of imagination and the creativity of a whole group of people, you know, starting with J.K. Rowling all the way down to David Yates, who did the last few movies.
Right.
And the Transformers series is about the death of imagination and creativity. So I want one thing celebrated over the other, I guess.
Absolutely. No, it's great. And even like to your point about, I keep saying to your point, please shoot me in the brain and charge the bullet to my family. I think that even where the movies, there's been no bad movies, but even the movies that aren't as successful, it almost mirrors the books in a way because you've got 7 books, it's 7 years at Hogwarts. I want to say probably the second movie and the second book, it seems the most, we talked about this at the last podcast, the most repetitive. It's kind of a replay of the first book. But what do you do when the character is 11 or 12 years old and they haven't really grown and there's really no challenges that they can take on yet? They don't know magic yet. So it's like, well, it's a pretty, you know, another stepping stone to bigger and better things. And even bigger and better directors, too, where it comes all of a sudden. I think it's Half-Blood Prince is the first one that's really kind of dark and interesting, but not scary and not like dark on purpose and like, oh, look how brooding we are. It's not like that at all. It's just it's more layered and leveled and ultimately interesting.
You saw the movie, before we move into spoilers, you saw the movie in IMAX 3D. I did not.
Did.
Can you speak to that experience a little bit? Should people go see it in IMAX 3D?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just a note about all the different variations in which you could see this movie. You've got the regular film projection, you've got digital projection, you've got real D 3D, and you've got IMAX 3D. I don't think there was an IMAX without 3D. I think the IMAX and 3D were together. But that's 4 different tickets you could possibly buy.
Right.
And I actually talked to a coworker yesterday who had bought tickets online. And he's like, yeah, I'm excited. I paid $10 a ticket. I'm like, oh, because you paid $10, I know that you got the basic either film or digital projection. And he's like, what, really? I wanted to get IMAX. And I'm like, well, you need to probably scroll down a little more and look for the IMAX because
you need to spend $18 or whatever.
It's like, remember DVDs when they're coming, you get the special box or the extended version, director's cut. It's like, just, you know, give me a little simpler options here. We did see it in IMAX 3D. And I'll tell you too, when that IMAX, the AMC specifically, when they're adjusting levels, and it's so freaking loud, which I don't mind. I like when movies are loud. In fact, a couple times I've seen movies that are the volume has been really low, and it's like you can hear all the crinkling of the cellophane and all that stuff, and it drives me crazy. I'd rather hear, like, especially in a theater, it's dark. I want the image to be bright and the volume to be loud, but it blows you away. It is scary. It's also needlessly, like, douchebaggy. It's like, we're adjusting tones. And I forgot all the kind of cliched things they say.
Laser aligned sound, yeah. And just like, you're making things up. Stop it.
Right. The 3D was not distracting.
Okay.
At first, it always is because I always feel cross-eyed. I'm not a proponent of 3D, although I'm not as big of a opponent as like Roger Ebert, who absolutely hates 3D. I'm not a hater. That's right. But I am not a huge, like, I could take it or leave it. I don't care. It wasn't as distracting. A couple things looked really cool. But I think the best part of the 3D was the experience I got when watching Happy Feet 2. That
because the one penguin sings "Mama Said Knock You Out," and then the other one sings "Sexy Back." Right.
The funniest thing is, and I talked about this on the Watching Trailers with Doug. There's I featured a trailer for Chipmunks 3. I think it's the third movie.
Yeah.
So Alvin and the Chipmunks 3 Chipwrecked, where it's on a cruise ship, and Alvin is on the front of the boat, and he goes, "I'm king of the world," and this is 2011, and then it goes to a Go-Go song for Vacation. It's a very short, like 30-second trailer, but I'm thinking like, hey, Titanic came out in 97, Go-Go's came out in 82, sorry. This has nothing to do with anything, and no one gets these references, except maybe me, and I'm not going to see this movie. And you, hopefully, if you're listening to this too, and I hope you don't see it, despite the fact that Jenny Slate and Amy Poehler are in it, because F you ladies, come on. Come on, I know money's important, but come on. Secondly, so you've got the Happy Feet 2 trailer where a penguin sings "Mama Said Knock You Out." I'm like, that came out when I was in, I don't know, junior high probably.
Yeah.
And that's not even like the sexy back is the parents of the kids who want to see, because kids are having kids when they're 16, 17 years old. When those kids were kids, Sexy Back came out. The kids who want to see this movie don't know any of these songs. It's completely irrelevant. It's the end of mankind.
I saw a couple shots in Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Look at you bringing it back to Harry Potter.
That's how I do, because we've gone off on a lot of tangents.
Whatever, dude.
I saw it just in regular 2D, you know, the basic. And I saw a couple shots where I was like, oh, and the movie, you know, was like post-converted to 3D. It wasn't shot for 3D. I saw a couple shots that I thought like, oh, that seems sort of designed to bring out the 3D, but I didn't feel like I was necessarily missing anything by not seeing it in 3D.
I think the IMAX is what really drove me towards the higher ticket price. Like, I want to see it on the biggest screen possible with laser-aligned sound.
If I could just see it in IMAX without the 3D, I totally would have.
That's what I would have done, too. And actually, our Logic 2, Shadia bought tickets online, and there was a great thing Fandango yesterday had, buy one, get one, including IMAX 3D. So we spent $16 for both tickets, which is a great deal.
Yeah.
So we also, our logic, which I think a lot of people had the same idea, was to buy the more expensive ticket and hopefully keeps the kids away, but it was still sold out and still a line that wrapped around the lobby to get into the theater, which is fine because it was, again, you're with the people that you want to see this movie with.
Yeah, right. I guess it's part of the fun.
Right. Although this movie had a lot of, especially, and it's not a knock, but sometimes I have a hard time understanding, not English accents, because English accents are pretty understandable, but when Seamus talked, it's like the Irish accent. There's a couple times I'm like, I have no idea what this guy said.
Yeah, there were a few lines of dialogue that I actually struggled with in this movie, and that hasn't been a problem for me in the past.
And even there's a couple jokes that were said where people then laugh, and then you miss the next part, which is also part of the joke, and I'm like, well, I guess I will watch it on DVD or something. But yeah, the experience I have, the 3D was good. I mean, I can't recommend it. It was just nice to see it in the biggest screen and just be like kind of immersed in it. And I think people liked it a lot. And actually, we were with a very diverse group of older people, younger people, and everyone was like, during the quiet parts, were like, you know, pitch quiet, if that's an
expression. Yeah, I noticed that in our showing as well, that nobody talked, which is great. You know, people were really, really interested in every second of the movie. So I guess we'll go into spoilers now. If you haven't seen the movie already, you kind of have already made your mind up. You either are going to or you're not, because you're a fan of these movies or you're not. So
just a note on that too, real quick. I know that some people out there haven't seen them. They're not movie watchers, but there's some people out there who are movie fans. And now at this point, I get that there's 8 movies later and it's become a cultural worldwide whatever. But at the same time, like, you're taking some weird pride in not seeing really good movies. I mean, maybe they're not great and you might not love them, but they're really good movies. And come on. I mean, if your whole stance is like just to be contrarian and just to be like, I haven't seen any of these movies and I won't and blah, blah, blah. I'm more interested in, you know, whatever.
Midnight in Paris.
Go fuck yourself. I mean, come on. Because go see everything. I mean, we see everything.
Right.
Patrick saw fucking the zookeeper, or just zookeeper, for Christ's sake. Granted, it was for a job, his zookeeper blog, but still.
All right, so let's move into spoilers for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. 1, 2, 3.
I can't believe Harry died.
Magic. I was surprised. I was surprised.
1, 2, 3,
by
magic.
That. But you cut me off with the Harry dying before I even gave people a chance to turn it
Sorry.
Off. No, that's fine. He's dead. Harry's dead. The movie's over.
Well, that's what I think would happen. My theory is that he actually dies, and everything that happens afterwards is just heaven or a dream of a Nargle.
I have some issues with the movie, and some of them go back to...
This movie blows.
No, some of them go back to just the J.K. Rowling book, I assume. I haven't read it. And some of them, are specific to the movie. My overriding problem with Deathly Hallows, really part 1 and 2, and this goes back to the book, so this isn't the fault of David Yates or Steve Clovis or whatever, is that as we are wrapping up this series, you know, there have been 6 movies that have come before, and there's definitely a continuity to all of them. But like in Deathly Hallows Part 1, in order to reach the conclusion, they introduce all this new mythology about the Deathly Hallows and the Horcruxes. And I just so wish that like it was more about paying off things that had come before, instead of like you have to go find all these new items that we've never been introduced to and that don't really matter. It's like, you have to find a tiara. Okay, how do I find the tiara? Well, you have to go talk to this ghost of a character who we've never met before. She's brand new, and she exists just to deliver this specific exposition and point you in the direction of this tiara, where I just so wish it was more about pulling all these different threads together that have come before. There's just so much introducing new stuff in order to get to the end, and that bums me out a little. But again, that's out of the book. That's not the movie's fault.
Especially when I think that you could have, and I don't remember specifically, like, I know for a fact that that character, the ghost of Ravenclaw, I think her name is, I forgot her name, the Gray Lady.
Susie Ravenclaw.
I think her name is Betsy Ravenclaw.
Her name is That's So Ravenclaw.
Nice. You nasty. That's right. That's So Raven reference. The Gray Lady is a ghost. And I want to say, and again, my memory of the books, I haven't read them in a couple years, is fuzzy. But I want to say that she was introduced at an earlier point, but never at the level of her importance seems to kind of dictate at the end. And again, you can't really fault J.K. Rowling. You've got, 4,000 or no, more than that, 5,000, 6,000 pages of this seven-volume book, basically, the whole series of Harry Potter. And so, like, yes, it's hard to wrap up. And even, like, some characters that appeared in the first few books and movies have nothing to do with the later books. Like, I remember Nearly Headless Nick was the Gryffindor ghost, and he is in the first movie a lot, I think, and just, you never see him again, which is fine because, honestly, there's a lot of going on. There's a lot to going on. That's my Italian. And you've got, in a book, it obviously makes sense. You've got all these, you can introduce all these characters and all these things and have them little, even tiny like C plots and D plots. In a movie, obviously, you want to stick to the overriding arc of the whole series and maybe possibly the plot of the specific movie. But yeah, I agree. I think it could have been another character. It could have been any other number of ways that he could have found the TR, because ultimately we kind of know what's going to happen. It's just waiting to get to that point,
Right. And that whole sequence wasn't necessarily particularly interesting. Again, I wish it wasn't just this tiara that was just introduced. I wish they would have said it's this thing from the, part three or whatever that this comes back. That's so cool. I understand J.K. Rowling wants to build this mythology and each house has a ghost and this is the Ravenclaw ghost or whatever. But when they first started, again, having not read the books, when they first started saying no one living has seen it, but so you have to go talk to someone who's dead. I thought for sure it was going to be that goofy girl ghost who lives in the bathroom.
I'm not attaching myself to you right now, but yeah. I honestly leaned over to Shadi because I don't remember the book. I thought it was Moaning Myrtle. I thought it was the same thing. I thought
which would have made sense to me. Like, that's a character we've met, and now she's able to give us useful information because until now she's just been this goof in the bathroom.
No, she gave us useful information. I think in the Triwizard Tournament, she told Harry how to open one of the things underwater. I think. I know, right? Whatever, dude. Don't judge me.
here's something that I like and dislike about the movie. And it makes me a hypocrite. I appreciate the fact that the movie is so consistent with the actors, that they've appeared in almost every movie, and to the point where in this movie, even if it's just for one shot, we get to see there's Emma Thompson. She played one of the teachers. She's only in one shot. She doesn't talk, but cool. I like how consistent it is and how they don't necessarily have to draw attention to and here's Emma Thompson's cameo.
Right.
At the same time, I would have the cliche lover in me kind of would have liked for some of these characters to matter more in the end and to kind of have a little bit more of a final bow. I mean, Hagrid gets to do nothing. Gary Oldman kind of shows up and his appearance is fine. I felt the only character who really got that moment that I wanted each person to have was Maggie Smith when she, not that I always wanted to say that spell or whatever, that's kind of lame, but she gets her own moment finally.
Well, she also, there's a great scene, I actually like it a lot, where Harry appears in Hogwarts when summoned, Headmaster Snape summons all the students and Harry appears and it's oh my God. And Snape draws his wand and is about to, I guess, attack Harry. And then, Maggie Smith, she steps forward. And there's a small pause, and then she just attacks him. Pretty great.
Right.
There's no build up. It's not this epic kind of conclusion build up. No, it's not she just starts whipping spells at him, and it was pretty badass. And then Snape escapes, and it's a pretty great scene.
So it's great that we get to see everyone. I like that Jim Broadbent is in it. He was one of my favorite things about Half-Blood Prince, but he doesn't really get to do anything, so I'm being a hypocrite because I wish they had done more, but at the same time I appreciate the fact that they're just there, they're part of the action, but they're not I don't know what I'm talking
about.
And
I think they're obviously confined to the two hour, 10 minute runtime of the movie, where you can't really do everything. Even like, but I did like, even there's the professor of plants, the short fellow.
Yeah.
And he had a cool little thing where his plants were attacking the it was like he was kind of in charge of all the stone statues guarding the thing and his plants. And it was kind of like, and if anything, I'll give this movie credit, the whole series actually, not just this movie. I give it credit for the most part. I know there's obviously some very obvious things, but for the most part, it's a fairly subtle, nothing is really hammered and said. Like at one point, like when we discover Harry is a Horcrux, it's never like a very, like this, a lesser screenwriter or a lesser movie would be like, just make that such a big deal. Like, Voldemort is inside me. I am right. You know, just like they'd make it such an
an epic conclusion. I agree. I absolutely agree with you. But at the same time, I felt like one of my sort of issues with Deathly Hallows Part 2 is that I think there are certain moments that needed to register more that don't. And I think while I don't want to see Harry be all bent out of shape that he's a Horcrux and Voldemort is inside of him, I think that the way that that's resolved, where he sort of allows that part of himself to be killed and we get the weird shot of the Voldemort baby or whatever, like that all happens very fast. That's a huge part of the overall mythology. And it's like, he finds it out, it's dealt with, and we move on, all in the span of about 10 minutes. And I just felt like, while I don't need to see him be tortured or whatever, I just felt like something like that should have registered more. I think there are a few... The movie almost cuts away from some of the more important things at times. I mean, characters die in the movie, which is fine. That's going to happen. But like, the movie isn't interested in really paying any attention to that. Again, I don't need every death scene to be this long, slow motion. No,
right.
You know, that I don't. That would suck. But like, at the same time, even just staying on, I don't know which Weasley brother was it.
I don't know their names.
One of the twins gets killed, and that's sad. And there's a good scene of the family like gathering around his body crying, but like it's a little too short. Even if it had held for 15 or 20 more seconds,
right,
I think we would have felt it more. There's the shot of Lupin and his wife or
Nymphadora Tonks.
Wow. Nymphadora Tonks. They've been killed, and it's a beautiful shot of them laying together dead, like touching hands. And it cuts away from it so fast that you're just like, oh, wait, they're dead. Nope, moving on.
You know, I disagree with some of that. I agree with one point specifically, and that point is I knew, obviously, having read the books, I know that one of the Weasley twins dies. And in the books, I think it's a little more, obviously, you know, get pages and pages to expound on, like, his death and the reaction to it. I didn't mind not seeing Lupin and Tonks' death.
I didn't need to see their death. I just think they could have held that shot a little longer.
And actually, I disagree. I think that shot was held fine. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I was satisfied because it was like a really, like you said, like just a well-composed shot. The thing with the Weasley brother is the quickness, to your point, about how quickly they showed different people having been killed. I think there's a girl, I think it's the girl who had a crush on Ron Weasley in a previous movie that gets killed also, or one of the girls from Gryffindor is dead. And they cut to her, and it's like, put a blanket over her, she's dead. And then they show the Weasleys surrounding a body, but you can't really even tell who it is. And of course, it's also, again, not a fault, but the book is like, there's a billion Weasleys. And part of that is like, there's a Weasley that's fighting dragons in Eastern Europe. There's a Weasley that's Percy. Is Percy back? I don't know. I don't recognize all these gingers who steal my soul. I don't recognize them. All I recognize is Fred. No, George. No, I mean Ron. Again, see, it's very confusing.
So, I just wish that some of those moments mattered a little bit more.
The twin specifically is what irked me. But to my what I said earlier about how I like that the movie had some subtlety and didn't hammer you over the head. A quick side note. I think the movies definitely work on their own terms. I think you can watch all 8 movies and that's a great, epic, sweeping conclusion. No, it's a sweeping series. It's really great. I really enjoyed it. I also think the books or the movies work as companions to the book. And I think that it works better in that respect. Not to say it doesn't work good or well, or it's not incredibly successful as just movies, but I think that as companions to the books, it's an unbelievable media presentation. You've got, you know, the book. If you want to go into more detail, you can read the books and see and hear all about. And I mentioned this on the last podcast. There's a whole B or C plot about Hermione giving house elves rights. And it's just like, oh, my God, I'm so glad that wasn't in the movies, because it's like even it's like, wow, this is just like page filler. It's like Dickensian, like I'm paid by the word filler. You know, it's garbage. Who cares? But I think that together they work really, really well. And that's why even I guess I wasn't as not to say I wasn't, again, affected by the same things you were, but it's I was willing to look past a little more because I know that, well, if I want more detail, I can go to this alternate companion piece. And even now that J.K. Rowling just launched Pottermore, that website, which I guess has role-playing games, and it's just a lot of interactive stuff for all the fans out there, that it's kind of crazy. But I did like the subtlety of a lot of it, even when specifically when Draco Malfoy comes back and is wanting his wand that Harry has, and they're in the Room of Requirement, and Crabbe sets the room on fire so they all have to escape, and it looks like Draco and his companion, this African-American or English, wait, African-English gentleman, are about to die, because at this point Harry, Ron, and Hermione have found brooms and they're flying away, and Harry's like, we have to save them. So Harry saves Draco Malfoy, they escape the room, they tumble off the brooms, and Draco, and a lesser movie, it would have been Drake, like Draco stands up first and helps Harry Potter up, you know, because that's like, we've seen that a billion times before. Right. And it works, because as an audience member, you see something like that and you're like, yes, they're friends, I'm so happy. But in this movie, Draco runs away because it's lots of conflicting, you know,
right.
And it almost makes you examine, for me at least, it's like, you know, Draco Malfoy, if nothing else, is a dick. He's just a jerk.
He's a coward, and he's always a coward, and so him running away is true to that character. And him at the end, when Voldemort says, you know, anybody who wants to join me, come over, the rest of you are going to die, Draco crosses over because he's a coward, you know? It's not like he says, like, no, I belong in Hogwarts, so, you know, he doesn't take his big stand. Like, no,
but a lesser movie would have had exactly that.
Absolutely.
Which would have made the audience very happy. Right. The audience who wasn't maybe, who hadn't read the books.
Who hadn't read the books, right.
Right, but it's definitely like the movie is giving a little more credit than most other kind of silly children fantasy magic movies, you know, because any other silly children's fantasy magic movie would have just be like the lamest, like, together we are one, you know, just all those cliched lame expressions that I'm glad this movie, and it has a little bit of that, but it definitely, I think, surpasses the mark.
There are a lot of moments in the movie that are great and that are super rewarding and pay off certain things and that are even sort of iconic. And then there are others, like I said, that feel rushed over. But there's a lot of moments that I like. I felt like the first moment that Ron and Hermione finally kiss, I mean, the audience kind of broke into spontaneous applause.
That was a good kiss, too.
It was so great. And it comes at just the right moment, and it's timed just right. And it really rewards what has been building for all these movies. And that's really, really great. I was super excited when they hopped on brooms again. We haven't seen them on brooms in a while. And, like, that was neat to see them older, still using those. I loved the first shot of the movie, which is just, it's like Hogwarts, but you see outside and there's all these Dementors. Is that what they're called?
Right. Yeah.
Super just like creepy and like really sets the tone right off the bat. I thought there were a lot of moments like that that I really liked. And then there were a few, like I said, that just felt kind of rushed over. And I wanted to see more of, I mean, the movie tries to find business for Ron and Hermione and they're always kind of helping Harry, but obviously, you know, they needed it to be just Harry's story, and it is so much in this movie, less so than in other movies. As a fan of Ron and Hermione, probably more than Harry Potter, I like it when the movie sticks with them. Like, I want to see them do more.
Well, even Harry Potter, when he kisses Ginny, they have a kiss, too.
Yeah, and I felt nothing.
It doesn't. Yeah, it's funny how much Ron and Hermione's kiss. It's actually, and I don't want to sound pervy, but it was like a really good, like, kiss, too. It was like, and when Harry kisses Ginny, it's just like, it feels like it's like there's two kids stage kissing, you know?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. There's another great moment, too. I think right after the kiss where Ron takes off after Draco and those other two guys, and it just holds on Hermione's face for a second where she's so like excited at how brave he is, or she's so like my hero. And that's really great. There's those moments throughout the movie that are really great.
That's what, again, separates these movies. Again, I think you said before your favorite, the Half-Blood Prince movie, it really kind of focuses on the teenage stuff, which I think has always been such a great element of these stories, more so than a lot of fantasy stuff, because a lot of fantasy stuff just focuses on the overarching major themes, the 30,000 foot, you know, kind of like the kingdoms fighting the kingdoms. And this is like about kids experiencing weird feelings towards other, you know, human emotion or wizard emotion, muggle emotion. And it's a lot of like, even when all this like stuff, Voldemort is going to kill everyone, you've still got like two people falling in love. And there's a scene, I think it's from Half-Blood Prince, where Hermione's really upset because Ron is like with this other girl and she, you know, and even in this movie, I want to say right after Voldemort is vanquished, there's a scene where Ron and Hermione walk in and they're holding hands. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it is given as much importance and weight to watch these two like little young people in love, where Harry gives them a look and he's like, what? You know, like they're so like awkward about it. It's so adorable. That's right. I'm 67 years old.
And we'll get to the payoff of that whole thing maybe at the end, the 19 years later. But right. Here's an idea I want to introduce. And this was the thing that I said, like, oh, there's one thing I want to address in spoilers. I recognize that the movie probably could not have done this. I will say that, you know, the movies are broken up part one and part two, and everybody says, well, that's just a cynical way to make more money, and that's probably true, but the book was so massive, how, you know, unless it was a four-hour movie, they needed to break it up. And I will say that they're broken up in a fine way. Like, the moment at which they split is fine, and they work sort of as individual movies in the way that, like, Kill Bill 1 and 2 do. However, there was something that was introduced about halfway to two-thirds in Deathly Hallows Part 2 that I was like, oh my gosh, that needed to be the split. And I recognize they couldn't have done that. It would have required changing too much, because I'm sure this was the point at which it was introduced in the book. It would have required changing too much, and people would have been really bent out of shape about it. But two-thirds of the way through the movie, Harry puts his face in the Snape tier pond and finds out this whole backstory about how Snape was in love with his mom and has basically spent his whole life trying to protect Harry, and that all of the things that he's done that we have perceived as evil were actually manipulations to get in with Voldemort to protect Harry. And that's great, and that obviously makes Snape much more interesting. You know, he's always been super interesting, probably just because it's Alan Rickman, but like...
Right, he's awesome.
Yeah. So that's more interesting. But he also finds out this kind of dark stuff about Dumbledore, that Dumbledore has basically just been grooming him to die with Voldemort.
Like a pig for slaughter.
Right, at just the right moment.
My English accent.
And Harry, then, finding out this information, accepts the fact that this is what he has to do. And it's this incredibly brave gesture. He's going to sacrifice himself so that Voldemort can die. He knows that he's going to die, but he goes to meet him anyway. And that's all great. But again, the movie rushes over that in the span of a few scenes. And watching it, I was like, oh man, that needed to be the split. And it couldn't have been, because there's not enough material that comes after it. But had Deathly Hallows Part 1 ended with that information that Dumbledore essentially has been deceiving Harry all the... And we find out that that's not necessarily the case, but like to believe that, and that Harry knows that he's going to die and has accepted that, going into part two, I think it makes for such a stronger movie, because it requires, you know what I mean? It's more about that journey of him facing this destiny, and also finding out that things aren't always, you know, so much of the series has been about kids finding out that like the world is kind of a harsh place and things aren't exactly black and white or what you think. And so that revelation about Dumbledore, I was like, oh my gosh, that is ballsy for like, I was thinking about J.K. Rowling writing it. I'm like, wow, she spent seven books like building up this guy as like his father figure, his protector, only to turn it and be like, no, he's actually kind of a dick and Snape is the good guy. And again, the movie turns, you know, it turns back around sort of where Dumbledore knew what he was doing all along and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But
just a word on Snape. I think that, and to my point earlier where I talk about the subtleties of the movie and how it's a very dense layered, you know, you've got Draco Malfoy, always a coward, even when he's saved and rescued by Harry, is still, you know, true to his coward form and doesn't fall into those pitfalls and traps of a more conventional movie. I think this thing with Snape too, and this is just in kind of deference to the book and a compliment to the book, you've got Snape always protecting Harry. And even in the books, you think he's just the biggest a-hole, jerk, evil, like at first he's just a jerk, you know,
right,
in the first, and then he just becomes the pure incarnation of evil, killing Dumbledore. And you find out that, like, no, he's protecting Harry. And what I find so interesting is, and the movie kind of touches on it briefly, is that Snape does all this because he's obviously a very good-hearted person and loves Lily. But the thing is, it's like he doesn't fall in love with Harry Potter. Harry Potter, like, he thinks Harry Potter is an asshole.
Yeah,
and, like,
right.
And
right.
He always has thought that. He's like, he's arrogant like his father. And I'm like, that's so interesting that he's not just this great, you know, wonderful child that everyone has to protect, like the Christ child. You know, it's right. It's like, right. No, I don't like this kid, but I understand the greater good.
Right.
And I just think, wow, that's really saying something. And likewise, the whole Dumbledore thing, I think it's interesting. It reveals not just Dumbledore being, I guess, more dimensional in terms of not just pure good and having some kind of negativity in him, you know, keeping a lot of things. By the way, Dumbledore is the most frustrating character in the history of anything, I think, just because everything is limericks and rhymes and you know, palindromes and just like, oh, and even this movie, you know, it does a little bit of that with the Grey Lady, too. It's like, if you need to ask, you'll never know. But if you know, you only need to ask. It's like, oh, fuck you. Come
well,
on.
Well, that's
like,
nonsense what you right. just said.
But even Dumbledore, just like even at the end, like in when Harry is struck with the death spell by Voldemort and goes to, quote, heaven, which is the King's Cross Station, and talks to Dumbledore for a while, he still gets no answers. It's like, dude, fuck you. I'm dead like you at this point. I mean, I can make a choice right now. Throw me a bone and, like, explain to me some things. Everything shan't be a riddle, you know?
Well, I thought that scene I thought was a little more...
I'm not even talking about clear. The scene. I'm just talking about just Dumbledore, like, just being an asshole,
right,
you know?
Right, but I did feel like that was a little more clear that he says, like, well, you can choose to go back or you can choose to go on,
right.
You know?
And it's, if nothing else, it's true to Dumbledore's character. But I find it, what's interesting is Dumbledore obviously is more dimensional, but also the Snape revelation that he's good also shines more light on the fact that Harry, who has a little father worship, you know, James Potter was the best, and how dare anyone speak ill of him? It's like, no, your dad was kind of a dick too. Right. Lily is the pure flower in this scenario, and it's obviously right. a testament and kind of a love story to a mom from both the child and the unrequited lover of hers, like his Patronus is a doe, as was hers, because he loved her so much. So I thought the Snape revelation was very interesting, and I knew it was in the book, but I knew it was coming, but I liked it so much. And if nothing else, kind of another side note, the Harry Potter world has mastered the ink in water special effect, and it does it so well, actually, too. I love it, like how it just kind of the black ink in the water forms right. the characters and stuff. It really works. What were you saying before? I had the 2 points I wanted to touch on Snape about. Oh, your point about the breaks in the two movies. I actually really, that's the first time I've heard that, but I think it actually really makes sense. And I'm not just agreeing with you to agree with you.
Thank you.
The first Deathly Hallows Part 1, it obviously is a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with it, because I remember some people, after it came out, some people were like, it's so good and so true to the book and sets up so much for the next movie. And some people are like, if you want to watch 3 hours of Harry Potter camping, then watch the Deathly Hallows Part 1. But that part of the movie, or that part of the series, the first part is so deliberately slow and starts, and it takes a long time to kill a Horcrux, and they're in the woods, and there's lots of pregnant pauses and silences and things like that. And if they got rid of some of that, like if they did had the same approach to the first part as they did to the second part, in that the second part, as you said, they rush over certain things. They rush over the killing of one of the Weasley twins. They rush over Tonks and Remus Lupin's death. They could have done a lot of that with the first one and expanded more, because obviously the seventh book, which is broken into two parts of the movie, is the biggest, very very long, very dense book. They could have easily, I think, had that be the turning point and extended this part of it, because you said like it would have been too disproportionate, even in terms of movie length. I kind of disagree, because I think that they rushed through a lot of things in the second one and they kind of stayed with a lot of things in the first one. And honestly, when the second movie started, and I kind of kicked myself because I wanted to watch the first part before I watched the second part to kind of have it more fresh in my mind. I forgot a lot of, like, why is the goblin there? Why is Ollivander there? Oh, because they were in the Falco's house in a basement or something. And it just, I forgot a lot of that stuff. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter because they're in one scene and they move on
right.
to the next part. But
right.
I think they could have definitely you know, skipped over some of that stuff and made the movie. But, you know, it's ultimately the movie still works.
I agree. I think the movie could have been about more than it's sort of about, because right now it's just sort of about Harry Potter defeating Voldemort and having love on his side. But like, I think it could have been about this search for this kind of father figure and finding out that it's not really Dumbledore and it's not even his actual father, because I like that you said, you know, he was kind of a dick. But again, the movie doesn't really go into that very much. And as much as I want to say, like, I appreciate that it doesn't have to hammer us over the head with that, that we just sort of get the gist of it. But, you know, again, it's really confined to just that one sequence. And the movie could have explored some of these themes and relationships a little bit better to be about more than just Harry has to find a Horcrux. Harry has to kill Voldemort. You know what I mean? Which is right. Basically all it's about, unfortunately.
I do like the one scene. It's right after Harry goes into Snape's thoughts, his memories, and he finds out that his dad is just kind of a jerk and Snape is, you know, in love. And then it cuts to Harry in the Forbidden Forest talking to the ghosts of his parents and Lupin and Sirius. And his dad's there. And it's kind of like, oh, hey. You know, right. He's focused on his mom and Sirius. And his dad, right. Like, gives him like a sideways glance. That's all right. He does. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty interesting. It's kind of like.
And of course. And doesn't name his own kid after him.
Right. So let's jump ahead 19 years later, which is the last chapter of the last book. So I think that we talked briefly before about the purists out there and they want things to be true. But I think that if they didn't include that sort of epilogue, it would have inflamed a lot of people. It would have made a lot of people upset.
I agree with you 100%, but I think the movie would have been stronger without it.
Possibly. And in a book form, again, it works really easily because right. you don't have an actor in age makeup. You could just say like, and even the line, Albus Severus Potter. In when you read it, it's like, oh, it makes sense. But like right. when you have Daniel Radcliffe say it, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, for sure. And my problem, again, aside from telling you, like, he ends up with Ginny and Ron and Hermione are together and they all have kids. And look, there's Draco and he's balding. that scene really, aside from saying like they lived happily ever after, has nothing to say. It's just like, look, it's come full circle. But like, okay, right. So what? Like, I guess I could have probably figured that out. I didn't feel like it had anything new to say about where Harry Potter ends up as a human being, as a result of everything he's been through.
I think the only thing it does do, it just kind of reinforces that, you know, he's ends up with Ginny. They have kids. Everything is okay. There's no return of Voldemort. Like, the world has moved on and the normalcy of life has returned, which obviously for the previous, you know, 7 years, that was anything but the normalcy of life. So you've got, you know, and I agree, the age makeup, you know, I'm actually kind of happy that they didn't go too far, because the first instinct again would be to like just dump on this makeup and prosthetics and things like that. And if nothing else, they gave him a little gray.
Right.
A little, you know, they made
it. It was fine. They still looked like kids. I mean, Ginny especially. It's like, look, she has shorter hair. But
she has a mom haircut. That was all it was.
She's 20, you know.
Right. And likewise with Hermione, they just gave her like little more bags under the eyes. I really thought Ron, what's Rupert Grint, in 19 years, big beer belly, bald, you know, bad skin. But they kind of like didn't go that far. And I wish they would have for comic purposes only.
They absolutely had to include it. So I understand. But like, I just felt like the shot of the three of them standing side by side, to me, said so much more than anything in that little epilogue.
Yeah, no, said. I think you're right. But I think that you and I we've talked before about how we're fans of the, not ambiguous ending, but we're more fans of the, you know, more, I guess, stylized, like, them three standing on the bridge and the camera pulls back and it shows the ruins of Hogwarts in the background is a powerful image. And I like it a lot more because it says so much more than you could write in three pages. And that's the interesting thing with film and books. It's like that does so much. We talked before about like Castaway. Like, I'm a big fan of like how he's at a literal crossroads and that's become the kind of the go-to example of that. But I like it. I like how, you know, it has those ambiguous endings and you could, however it ends, you like you're the fan, you're the audience, you take with it away with it what you want. But unfortunately, a lot of people, especially those who maybe aren't as well versed, not to say we're well versed, but those who aren't aren't big story readers or followers, want the concrete ending. They want that sort of that closure, that conclusion. That's like, okay, phew, now I know that like there's no return of Voldemort. But of course, it's incredibly frustrating to those who care about narrative structure.
I just felt like we knew that there wouldn't be. The whole point was that there wouldn't be a return of Voldemort. You know what I mean? Like, he's dead forever. So, again, that epilogue doesn't tell me anything. Because as the movie ends, you know, now or 19 years prior, like, Ron and Hermione are together and Harry and Ginny are in love. And so to show us like, oh, and they're still together, that's not really new information. It really only would have been a turn if like we didn't know that him and Ginny had something going on and all of a sudden like they're together and they have kids. It'd be like, what? They ended up together? That's crazy.
He's with the Asian girl again. It's like, wait, I thought you guys, what?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and what? She has an Irish accent? That's fascinating. That's cool.
That's all of a sudden really, really awesome now that she's a little more grown up. one of the last things I want to say is, like I mentioned a couple times before, I read a lot about, after I saw the movie, I went online and was gauging people's reactions to it. And, you know, the movies are, the books and the movies are so successful and they're so popular and beloved and everyone is just totally infatuated with these things. And it's not my theory, but the reason is because they are finite. It's limited. You've got J.K. Rowling writing these books. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's very specific and very the arc of the story is so deliberate. And likewise, the movies, they end. It's over. And that's the reason why it is as successful as it is. If every movie had a cliffhanger with we don't know what's coming next,
right,
it wouldn't be – the quality would just be – have gone down just because we've seen that a billion times before with any superhero movie. Any sort of sequel, it can ever live up to the first one because obviously all the energy is put into the first one, whereas these books, the energy is put into – especially the movies because the books all existed or not all of them, but they knew kind of where it was going. So the energy is on the story as a whole as opposed to the individual stories. Mm-hmm. But I'm blown away by people online, like on Twitter specifically, like, I can't wait to see what happens next. Why can't they make a ninth movie and focus on the next generation of Hogwarts students? Because you've got Albus Potter and his classmates and it should focus on them and like the new class. And I'm thinking like, that is the worst idea I've ever heard. You've
Albus got Albus's new friend, Weasel?
Right, exactly. Instead of Screech, it's Weasel. It's Degrassi, it's everything that's awful. Right. I'm thinking like, what would be the opposition that could possibly compare to Voldemort? Voldemort is the incarnation of evil.
Right.
It is he killed.
Well, just have him come back. Like, I think the people that want to, I think those people are unwilling to accept that it's over and move on. And so they're just as happy to like, well, have Voldemort come back. Cause then it's just the same thing I like. But again, you know,
right. And that's the reason again, not to beat a dead horse, but it's the reason why the movie is so successful. And it's that double-edged sword of the catch-22 of the other cliches. It's the you've got the perfect movie that makes millions upon a billion people happy, and all they want is more. And you gotta feed the dragon, you know. Right. But you can't. It's perfect as is. I'm not perfect, but actually it is. It's perfect. It's fine. It's a perfect little thing. Even all the small gripes aside, it exists. It's really successful. It makes me very happy. I was very happy last night. I got really excited when I see like the stone statues jumping down and defending.
That's badass. Yeah.
I get like in a weird way. Like there was a girl actually. I have to say this. I know we're pushing the envelope right now, but there was a scene where one of the Weasley twins dies, and there was a girl. It was silent in the theater, and I hear some sniffles because it's an emotional scene. There was a girl who full out busts out like the heavy-hearted, heaving cry. She's like, Shadi leans over. We start like laughing, and I'm like, I feel bad that this girl is so just obsessed with these stories. I'm like, come on now. But that's what it does, you know. The books and the movies obviously affect people in such a way that they just want more, and you know, you can't make everyone happy.
Way to go, Harry Potter. Good job.
Yeah.
Way to stick the landing. I hope this movie makes a bunch of money, and I hope it is more successful than Transformers. Obviously, it's not going to win any Oscars, but
it'll be up for an Oscar, I think.
You think?
And I actually heard some critics say it was the best movie of the year, but I'm like, I don't know about that.
That is insane nonsense. It has been a very bad year, but like,
but it might be the same thing too with like Lord of the Rings. Like, it's a more of a reward for the entire
stuff
of the thing, even though it's different directors and stuff.
And I have no idea how the year is going to go. Obviously, right now I feel like no, that's probably not going to happen, but maybe. I mean, who knows? I think that, you know, the achievement should be acknowledged. I guess it is financially because people really love these and they'll live on for a really long time. And that's, I guess, all you can ask for. You know, I think these movies will be around forever.
Absolutely. I can't wait to watch them with my kids who don't exist.
Albus Cerberus Doug.
That's right. Albus JB Patrick Doug.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Doug, take us out.
Mischief managed.